interesting and good and lunch. We had nice Mediterranean for myself. So any ethnic cuisine you want, pretty much you can get here in Berkeley somewhere. Yeah. So. Okay, so we're going to continue the afternoon sessions, and our first speaker here is Steve Fuller, giving that keynote address, and the title is Berkeley, : Mecca and Microcosm of the Psychology of Science. So here we go.
Okay. Thank you very much, Greg. I'm not going to put this too close to my face, because otherwise it'll explode, I think, because I talk pretty loud, but if you don't hear me, let me know. First of all, I want to thank Greg for inviting me to speak here. I happen to be writing the entry on the history of the psychology of science for the handbook of the psychology of science that Greg is editing, and which I haven't finished yet, and I'm just letting you know I'm on record here. I'm working on it, and in a sense, what I'm going to talk about today is extracted from this, because in a way, you might say Berkeley is a very good rhetorical hook to bring up a lot of issues related to the psychology of science, because a lot of the most interesting thinking, in a way, passed through here at various points in the 20th century. Let me begin by sort of, in a way, recalling some of the stuff that was brought up in the first keynote address about what exactly the psychology of science is. Both Klar and Feist brought this up. We might think of the psychology of science as doing many different things. One of them, I was very struck by raising Galton, for example, is if you look at somebody like Galton, right, scientific thinking is regarded as kind of, you might say, in a sense, a naturally occurring phenomenon that we're trying to cultivate in some way. Right? So it's already there in the world. There are people who are scientists. We know who they are, and we'd like more of them. And so the question is, how do we get them? And so there's a sense in which there was a very strong kind of normative orientation to this kind of research, which of course, you know, this research fed into what we call eugenics, which was one of Galton's coinages. I'm not going to be talking about that very much, but there is an aspect of this that's relevant to the story I'm going to tell. Then you might say that there are two different other conceptions of the psychology of science. And then after that, I'm going to talk about two others, so we're not finished yet. The first two that I want to talk about, and just briefly again, were in a way brought up in the discussion this morning. One of them is tied to this business of the coinage of the psychology of science as the title of a book, Abraham Maslow, from 1966. And there, I think, the way you have to understand what's going on in that book, very much in the spirit of the times, is that there's a sense in which there's a concern that one ought to worry about the psychologist of scientists if they are mechanistic, reductionistic, etc. And so in a sense, part of the punchline of that book is that scientists need to have a kind of more holistic, integrative approach to approaching the world, especially given the significance that they have in terms of their ability to predict and control phenomena. And in fact, if we don't have that kind of more holistic approach to science, science could well destroy the world or something like that. So there's a sense in which there is a plea to sort of broaden out. The psychology of science becomes this kind of strategy for broadening out the training of scientists. And so one of the figures who's in fact very influential in Maslow's thinking is Michael Polanyi, okay, of personal knowledge fame. And so there's that whole side there. Now, there's another sense of psychology of science, which I think actually rises in Greg's book from 2006, Yale University Press. I don't know if you've got copies to autograph or whatever. But the interesting aspect of that conception of the psychology of science is that it's basically the application of the different branches of psychology to the study of science, which is something quite different from what Maslow was trying to do. Because there's a sense in which when Maslow calls it the psychology of science, he's problematizing scientific thinking. You know, what is the psychology of these scientists and how do they think about the world too narrowly, right? And we need to fix that up, right? Whereas with Greg, right, we're starting basically with the idea that we've got a science of psychology already on the ground. It has many different branches, does many different things. And as it were, science might be one of the final frontiers that psychology has yet to colonize, you might say. And so the book is organized in a way that you go through the various branches of psychology and you show what their applications are to the study of scientific thinking. And the second half of the book, interestingly, is a kind of naturalistic take on what exactly, how exactly the scientific mindset arises as part of the evolution of the species, basically. Okay, so it's part of a kind of general evolutionary epistemology. So I would draw the distinction, not to be kind of exclusivist about it, but I do think, you know, Maslow's sense of psychology of science is much more humanistic in a way, and sort of operating on the assumption that the scientist is kind of a narrowed human being, whereas Greg is operating with a naturalistic conception of science as something that emerges, as it were, out of the development of human beings as a species. Okay, so there are these two different takes on that. Now, there's a further distinction I want to draw, and this is a distinction that will start getting us toward the Berkeley issue, and that has to do with the sense in which the psychology of science is, in a way, another way of talking about debates that have always existed within the science of psychology itself. And this was touched upon, I think, by Clark very well in terms of whether the scientist should be thought about as a distinctive kind of thinker, or as in some sense a continuation or another version of normal thinking. Okay, so there, and now this distinction, I think, is quite a powerful distinction, quite important distinction, and one that arises very much. Because if you look at, for example, E.G. Boring's History of Experimental Psychology, right, one of the early chapters about the history of psychology is about the personal equation. Okay, and the personal equation is basically about the psychology of astronomers. Right, and the problems of error and bias and things of that kind in terms of trying to get astronomical observations on target. Okay, and in a sense, a lot of the stuff having to do with psychophysics, which is kind of the foundation of this discipline, arose out of this kind of reflexive consideration, you might say, about the psychology of scientists. And in particular, astronomy, which historically is kind of a foundational science, right? If you look at the way in which we normally talk about the history of science, even when we start off with physics, right, it's always through astronomy. So there's a sense in which there's a lot of symbolic value, as it were, in grounding the history of psychology in the history of the psychology of astronomy. Okay? And so in a sense, the psychology of science has kind of always been with the history of this discipline, okay, though not necessarily under that name. Okay? And I think it's not by accident, for example. I mean, Greg brought up the issue of S.S. Stevens, right, who's very much in that psychophysical measurement tradition. That, in a sense, is hearkening back to this issue that Boring raises in his History of Experimental Psychology. Okay, so there is this business about, in a way, psychology's always been preoccupied with the scientist. Now, what kind of a being is the scientist? What kind of a thinker is the scientist? Now, on the one hand, you might say the scientist is a highly specialized kind of thinker. Okay, and when we talk about scientific expertise, and nowadays that's become a very popular way to sort of cloak all this stuff, right, there's a sense in which science is in some way strange. It may be very good, it may be very bad, whatever, but it's different. And in a sense, if you want to understand the nature of scientific thinking, you have to understand the ways in which it is idiosyncratic, you might say, or the way in which it deviates from normal modes of cognition. Now, this kind of idea has been very much present within the history of psychology, and one place where this issue comes up very strongly is in the turn of the last century, in this famous debate between Ernst Mach and Max Planck, which philosophers of science typically portray as being about whether or not atoms exist, right? So it's about the existence of unobservable entities. But actually also has something to do with what the nature of scientific thinking is. And one of the arguments that Mach was making against the existence of atoms, which are these very strange entities that can only be understood indirectly but not through any direct empirical observation, right? This is the state of play around the turn of the century, right? Is that in a sense, this displays the artificiality of scientific modes of thought. So in other words, atoms are good as kind of hypothetical constructs, you might say, for making sense of reality, but one should reify these things or somehow think that the scientific mode of thought that's represented that way is in some sense some natural way of thinking about the world. In other words, we do not necessarily want to see the world as an atomic physicist does. And in a sense, Mach, in fact, has a very kind of self-delimiting view about the relevance of scientific knowledge to the human condition. Okay, and if you look at the full range of Mach's writings, in many respects, they're not so different from Maslow in their tone. So in other words, he's not anti-science by any means, but he believes that science is a specialized form of cognition. Right, and that one of the problems with this, you might say, what we would call in philosophy of science, scientific realism, right, is that in a sense it reifies these kinds of entities beyond their instrumental value. Okay, so there's that kind of view. Now, if you want to say, well, what's the lineage of this kind of view? Well, I mean, Mach, in his book, The Science of Mechanics, which is a kind of a history, you might say, of the rise of Newtonian mechanics and the objections that were made to it, which influenced Einstein's thinking very much. One of the things is this idea that science, that, you know, you get from the ancient Greeks, science is something you do in leisure. Right? Science is not the normal way of approaching the world. Science is what you do once you finish the jobs that you have to do in order to stay alive. So science comes after the fact of survival. It's a surplus. Right? And that's one of the reasons why we consider it a mark of civilization and all the rest of it. But one shouldn't, as it were, overestimate this. One should, as it were, make it kind of the whole thing. Okay, so that's kind of where Mach is coming from here, and so, you know, there's precedent within Plato and Aristotle and stuff like that about science is a rather specialized activity that only certain groups of people in rather privileged positions engage in and do have important consequences, but are kind of limited in a way. Now Planck, Max Planck, had this opposite view. He was very much a promoter of the atomic worldview and so forth, and his view, which is the view that turns out to be quite influential in the 20th century, and hooks up with the Berkeley story, is the idea that scientific thinking is consciousness, you know, is ordinary cognition rendered self-conscious. Okay? Now, this formulation, that scientific thinking is ordinary thinking rendered self-conscious, is something that you find explicitly stated by Wolfgang Köhler of the Gestalt School, who was a student of Max Planck. Okay, and I think it's very important here to see the degree to which, you know, Planck's influence is not just in physics, but also in psychology. And a lot of these early psychologists, of course, as you all know, right, had very strong backgrounds in physics, and Köhler was particularly influenced that way. Okay, and so the whole idea of thought experiments, for example, which is a very strong theme within the cognitive theory that the Gestalt people were pursuing, right, that thought experiments are not weird things that only Einstein does, right? But rather is a kind of very self-conscious, methodical way of the way in which people normally think. And in fact, this is one of the reasons why you want to study scientists, right? So you want to study the diaries of scientists, in the case of Carl Duncker and so forth, that you want to actually look at these people who are particularly self-conscious about stuff that people normally do, right? So scientists become a kind of exemplar of ordinary human cognition, and there's a lot of value being placed on that. Okay. Now, this view, as I said, I think becomes very influential within psychology, and in to such an extent that I think very often you end up getting a blurring of whether in a given experiment or in a given discussion about psychological phenomena, whether one's talking about the subjects or one's talking about the scientists studying the subjects. Okay, there's a kind of a lot of blurring that has gone on, and this is something that was already noted at the beginning, you know, of this kind of way of thinking. The Würzburg School, you may know about these people, are sort of precursors to the Gestalt School. These were people who believed in the idea of imageless thought, right? That there's a sense in which thinking isn't just an emergent feature of our sensations of the world, but rather has a kind of autonomy and a kind of directed tendency that one can introspect in a sort of self-disciplined manner. And that the sort of people who ought to be engaged in this enterprise are themselves people who are already scientists, right? This was always kind of the punchline of this kind of approach, right? The subjects of the experiments were these very knowledgeable people, right? It's the sort of thing that we would now say, oh, this introduces bias of all kinds. No, this was in fact treated as an advantage. And of course, Wilhelm Wundt, right, who's normally seen as a great father of experimental psychology, inveighed against this, really disliked this, thought that this was in fact not scientific, and in a sense that was kind of the final verdict of history, at least for a long time. Right, that basically you had a lot of navel-gazing PhDs going on here, okay? Whatever you make of what the Würzburg people were up to, nevertheless, they are people who believed in this basic idea that scientific thinking is ordinary thinking rendered self-conscious. Right, so in a sense, studying themselves is just as good as studying anyone else. Only they're more articulate, and that's a good point. Okay, so I do think that there is a kind of an interesting sort of history here. Now, when we start to move into where the Berkeley story applies, there's another piece of the puzzle I need to add. Okay, because I'm going to be working my way up. How much more time I have? See if I ever get down to this. T minus 38. What do I have?
25 minutes.
Oh, 25 minutes.
Okay,
Okay, here are the people I want to be talking about here. These are people who at various points were at Berkeley, especially if we're talking about the 1930s. We want to talk, of course, about Edward Chase Tolman. Okay. We want to talk about Egon Brunswick, who Tolman hired from Vienna. And Brunswick was a student of Karl Bühler, okay, who was the chair in developmental psychology, and he was one of the second generation Würzburg school people, okay? And so Tolman hires him. Another person who's a classmate of Tolman at Harvard, I'll go into this in the morning, Stephen Pepper, who was chair of the philosophy department at the same time that Tolman was there. Some of you may know who Stephen Pepper is, okay? And then, you know, as we go downstream a bit, we get, you know, guys you may have heard of like Thomas Kuhn and so forth, who spent two or three productive years at Berkeley after he got bounced out of Harvard for not getting tenure. Before he went to Princeton, he was at Berkeley, okay? And so we're talking about 56 to 59 or something like that, right? And it's during this period that he actually writes the first draft of The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, okay? The book is based largely on general education and science courses that he taught when he was at Harvard before he got booted out. But the point is that the writing of the book occurred there, and it was there that he made the acquaintance of Paul Feyerabend, of course, who was here as well. And there's a correspondence that you can look into about that. So his point is Berkeley's quite an important place here for the development of the psychology of science. And I'm just, as we're sketching out the main players for you now, right this moment, but let's go through this a little more slowly here, okay? So there is the interesting story to be told. And the story starts back at Harvard, where everything begins in the United States, right, in terms of academic stuff. And this is a story, this is not a story of, this is a story, you might say, more, in a way, more about common descent than mutual influence. Okay, especially with the Harvard thing. Because, and what's the common descent? You know, what's the Ur moment is William James. Okay, William James, if you look at the Principles of Psychology, 1890, and you go to chapter 12, on conception, that's where you get this first systematic, for James at least, discussion of conceptual scheme. Okay, conceptual scheme. And this is kind of like the linchpin notion, you might say, for the psychology of science, that certainly by the time we get to Kuhn paradigms and so forth is the kind of, you know, if you want to kind of have a red trace through the history of the psychology of science, the idea of conceptual scheme is a very important one. Okay. Now I think nowadays we have a fairly flabby notion of what a conceptual scheme is. Right? I mean, it's just this kind of mental framework, blah, blah, blah kind of stuff. But in fact, it was a very specific kind of issue that James is concerned about, which in a way, I don't know how many of you have ever read The Principles of Psychology, but there's a sense in which William James is engaged in kind of an internal dialogue with all sorts of characters, right, in philosophy and psychology in Europe in the late 19th century. And in a sense, you have to read a lot of it to figure out what the targets are and what the point of making the move is and so forth, okay? And one distinction, the idea of a conceptual scheme, as James initially describes it, is as a sieve. Okay, he uses this term, sieve, technical term, right? Sieve, technical term from the kitchen, at least. Sieve. And the idea here is that the conceptual scheme captures certain things in the world, and the other stuff just drops out. Okay, and that's pretty straightforward. Then the question becomes, what happens to the stuff that drops out, okay? And this is an interesting kind of question, and in a sense, pragmatism emerges. I don't know how much you people are familiar with Tolman or Brunswick or any of these guys that kind of follow along these lines, but there is a kind of distinction that gets made a lot. I forget which one of these guys actually makes it, but they all make this kind of distinction. You'll know what I mean when I go there. Discriminanda and manipulanda. Is this Tolman?
Tolman, yes.
Okay, all right. Okay, So the idea here, right, is the conceptual scheme under normal circumstances is kind of this web of discriminanda, right? It enables you to discriminate things. This is the civ-like function of the thing. But then there's this issue of manipulanda, and this has to do with your getting around the world. And in a way, manipulanda gets distinguished from discriminanda when your discriminanda doesn't quite get what's going on out there. When you move around the world and you start hitting roadblocks and things. And you have to start adjusting in some way. Something's got to get adjusted. Something's got to give. Okay. And in a sense, for James, this is kind of how some kind of conceptual development takes place. Now, the interesting thing about James in all this is James is very keen on this kind of a distinction being made. Okay? In other words, that there be a strong distinction between the conceptual scheme, which is the discriminanda primarily, and then this stuff in the outside that either passes through it or provides obstacles, which then the manipulanda in some way negotiate. Now, I say this because if you think about the way in which a lot of philosophy and also a lot of evolutionary thinking has developed, there's been a tendency to sort of reduce this kind of distinction to, in a sense, not to stress the distinctiveness of the conceptual scheme, to say, well, in a sense, organisms are very plastic, they're very flexible. In a sense, whatever schemes they have are very much maps of particular aspects of the environments that they're in. Right? So we talk about modularity, for example, in evolutionary psychology and so forth. This is not what James has in mind. Right, James has in mind a kind of rather unified conception of the organism operating in the world with goals and directions and purposes and things of that kind. And that in a way, when the world presents obstacles to it, this is an opportunity, as it were, for the ego to reassert itself through the conceptual scheme. Okay, so that's a very important part of this kind of equation. So while on the one hand it is evolutionary, it is directive, right? On the other hand, it also involves a very strong sense of what the individual self is. And this is something that becomes, that becomes kind of an issue because, so for example, when you're talking about rats and things like this, as Tolman does down the line, how appropriate is this kind of conception? Okay. But this, I think, is a very... Now, where is James coming from in this? Well, James is basically a person who you might say has a kind of empiricist sensibility. So in a sense, he wants to believe that, sensations impact on us and, orient our ways of thinking about the world. But at the same time, he also believes that there is some sense in which it only makes sense once it's unified. So he has this kind of Kantian idealist thing going on, too. And the conceptual scheme is basically his resolution of that idea within a kind of reasonably experimental empirical framework. Okay. This is an idea that I think, in a way, he very much persists in promoting and becomes very influential in the history of science. I mean, one place where it becomes very influential is in a person who, as soon as he got the PhD from James, immediately moved to Berkeley, and that was C.I. Lewis. Okay. By the way, people like Tolman and Pepper and Lewis, we call Tolman a psychologist, we call Pepper and Lewis philosophers. All these people got PhDs in philosophy. Okay, there's no distinction at Harvard between the philosophy and psychology department until 1930. In fact, Berkeley is a place that does start to make these distinctions. Okay. How many of you heard of C.I. Lewis? Okay, some of you have. Okay. C.I. Lewis is a very important figure in the history of American philosophy, not only because he was very important in the establishment of the philosophy department at Berkeley, but also when he came back to Harvard in 1920, he initiated this vast project collecting together the papers of Charles Sanders Peirce, and in fact kind of masterminded this sort of originary myth of the United States as this great center of pragmatism. If you do a history of American philosophy, it's a history of pragmatism, James Peirce Dewey, right? This is Lewis's kind of invention, in a way, you might say. Okay, one of the things that Lewis got very much from William James was this idea of a strong distinction between a conceptual scheme and, as it were, the world that one has to sort of negotiate with. The way he articulated this through a series of lectures that he gave at Berkeley, and then after he left Berkeley in 1920, he would come back every summer to do some summer teaching as well, so he has a sort of very long connection with this place. is that he starts to articulate something that looks a lot like Kuhn's theory of paradigms. Okay, and in fact, this is a, I'll read you a little bit of what he wrote in one of these lectures he gave at Berkeley in 1926. Okay, and this was one that actually very much influenced Tolman's general thinking about the psychology of science. I'm going to read this to you. And to me, this sounds like it could have just very easily have come from Thomas Kuhn. Okay, but this comes from a man who was a student of William James. Words such as life, matter, cause, and so on have been used since thought began, but the meanings of them have continuously altered. There is hardly a category or principle of explanation which survives from Aristotle or the science of the Middle Ages. Quite literally, men of those days lived in a different world because their instruments of intellectual interpretation were so different. To be sure, the telescope and microscope and the scientific laboratory have played an important part. As time goes on, the body of familiar experience widens, but that hardly accounts for all the changed interpretation which history reveals. Not sense observation alone, but accord with human bent and need must be considered. The motive to control external nature and direct our own destiny was always there. Old principles have been abandoned, not only when they disagreed with newly discovered fact, but when they proved unnecessarily complex and bungling, or when they failed to emphasize distinctions which men felt to be important. Okay? And so there, in a nutshell, you have a kind of a view, Kuhn's view, of how paradigms change, where this is anomalies accumulate over time, right? And then after a certain point, you cannot reconcile these to the dominant paradigm, so you shift to a new paradigm. This is what Lewis is talking about in this lecture given at Berkeley in 1926. Okay? Now, the interesting difference between, and this influences Tolman a lot, this kind of way of thinking, because Tolman's not just interested in rats. In fact, he did not start off by being interested in rats. He only became interested in rats when he got here, and he started teaching a course in comparative psychology. Humans and rats, okay? But before that time, he does a PhD in philosophy and with his classmate, Stephen Pepper, okay? They are working under Ralph Barton Perry, who's one of James's students. So this is a philosophy PhD, and so he's very much taken by this kind of thing that Lewis is saying at the time, and he's trying to figure out how exactly to operationalize this, how one might study this kind of phenomena, okay? And it's in this context that Tolman comes up with this idea of cognitive map, which you may know about, right? Tolman's idea of cognitive map, originally attributed to rats, right? But really, you know, in a sense, modeled on this kind of conception of human beings, right, that C.I. Lewis and the whole Jamesian tradition had been promoting. Okay, now the difference between what people like Lewis and Tolman were up to in terms of this idea of conceptual scheme, cognitive map, and what somebody like Kuhn later on would be up to has a lot to do with the point of the cognition, the focus. You know, we talk about the functionality of the cognition, right? The cognitive map is a map of something that's meaningful to the organism that has it. What defines that horizon of meaning? Okay, William James and Lewis and Tolman, and this would also go same thing for Egon Brunswick, right? The horizon of meaning is the life situation understood in the broadest possible terms. Okay, so for example, according to Lewis, when William James gave a lecture on the Copernican Revolution, what exactly was going on when that shift took place, that meaning shift took place, it wasn't merely a matter of scientists finding a more economical way of doing calculations or something like that. It was rather this kind of broader sense of the, you know, they can see the world in a different way and their lives have different meaning, right, as a result of this kind of shift. Okay, so it's a much broader kind of existential change than somebody like Kuhn talks about, where paradigm changes for Kuhn happens when, as it were, technical problems cannot be solved by technical means anymore and you have to shift to another paradigm so you can then solve those technical problems better. Okay? So the functionality is different. People like James and Lewis and Tolman and Brunswick basically, again, have this attitude that the scientific thinker is like the ordinary thinker, only more self-conscious, right? The functionality that we're talking about, the reason why we have cognitive maps and paradigms, is to orient ourselves through life in general, not simply to orient ourselves to a scientific discipline, and as it were, the issues arising there. Now, the interesting question is, where exactly is Kuhn coming from? And Kuhn, as I said, spent all this time at Berkeley. He was hired by Stephen Pepper to teach a course in history of science within the philosophy department, which is something that both Tolman and Pepper had wanted for years. So there's that kind of backstory to be told. Okay, and the question is, why didn't Kuhn exactly share this picture of this kind of broader sense of paradigms and cognitive maps as having this kind of functionality for life as such? And this is where James Brian Conan comes in, the president of Harvard University. You may know about him, who, as I said, was the guy who gave Kuhn his first job as an instructor in general education after the war. Kuhn's a PhD in physics, right? He's not a historian or philosopher or anything. He's a physicist by training. Okay, and Conan, president of Harvard, says what we need are, in the post-war period, are non-scientists understanding the nature of science, and it's in this context that Kuhn's structure of scientific revolutions was written. But Conan's view about this whole William James picture of conceptual schemes and cognitive maps and all this was one that was very much limited to the specialist community. Okay. And that was because, basically, Conan believed that this is where Conan has this alternative view I was talking about earlier, where there's a sense in which scientific thinking is a very specialized form of thinking. It isn't something that's just, as it were, ordinary thinking rendered self-conscious, but is, in fact, a very disciplined kind of thing. I should also add that Conan also believed there shouldn't be too many scientists in society. He believed that, in fact, right, it was more important that ordinary people in society were pro-science and supported science than there'd be a lot of people doing science. Okay, so that's one implication of the kind of thing Conan... So Conan, in this regard, is close to Mach. Okay, in this respect. Namely, that science is specialized, but that doesn't mean everybody ought to be doing it. In fact, it only means a certain group of people ought to be doing it. And they should be respected for doing it. And this view took hold very much with Kuhn. Okay, and so Kuhn ends up having this rather kind of narrow view, but nevertheless part of the same sort of lineage and trajectory that comes from William James, moves through people like C.I. Lewis, who comes to Berkeley earlier, and then 10 years later we get Pepper and Tolman at Berkeley doing the same sort of thing, and then Tolman hires Egon Brunswick from the Würzburg School, who continues pursuing a line very similar to this as well. And among the people of the following generation who get trained in this way of thinking is Donald Campbell. Okay, and you know about Donald Campbell, probably the most important methodologist of the social sciences, at least in the second half of the 20th century, I would say. Okay, and he's a product of this trajectory as well. And if you look at the way, the kind of approach that Donald Campbell has to methodology, it is very much kind of self-conscious epistemology. Okay, it's a much very broad kind of conception of methodology, and it's very much in this tradition that I've been outlining here. Okay, how much more time do I have, if any?
Maybe 5 more minutes to talk, so if you want 5 more minutes of questions.
Okay. Okay, so let's put a parenthesis around this. There are a lot of questions that one can ask about this. I would recommend, by the way, those of you who are interested, because this whole area that I'm talking about here really has not been put together very much at all. I mean, I'm basically drawing together things from quite different literatures that don't normally interact with each other. But if you look at somebody like Lawrence Smith, for example, on logical positivism and behaviorism, a book from about 15, maybe more, 25 years ago, yeah, Stanford University Press, 1986. Okay, there you actually have chapters devoted to the psychology of science under that name of not only Tolman, but B.F. Skinner and Clark Hull as well, the other two major behaviorists in America. Also, I would recommend, there is this enormous volume that Kenneth Hammond put out about 10 years ago on the psychology of Egon Brunswick, which has a lot of the backstory and a lot of the detail about what was going on in Berkeley and so forth. And also, Donald Campbell. Donald Campbell's article in the seminal Psychology of Science volume that the Memphis State University people put out in the late 1980s with Cambridge, there's an article by Campbell there which gives you a lot of clues as to where to look at stuff. So there's a lot of things to explore here. And the interesting thing that one runs across, especially when one looks at somebody like Tolman, who's actually promoting psychology of science as a field within Berkeley, is how little traction he got with this. Okay, and this is one thing that Smith's book talks about, how nobody was interested in this. And one place to go to look at, who actually, Tolman, as you Toman had a lot of interaction with the logical positivist. Moritz Schlick, who was the head of the Vienna Circle, he used to vacation at Stanford, okay? And Toman knew him as well and traveled a lot to Vienna, and that's how he met Brunswick in the first place. One of the people who Toman really impressed, and in fact Toman was the chair at the last meeting of the International Congress of Unified Science, the great positivist kind of interest group, was here in 1953. It was the last time it met, all right? And Toman was the president at that time, and he gave a paper to whom a very important figure, Arne Naess. Are you familiar with him, the Norwegian philosopher? He recently died. He's often known as the founder of deep ecology. But he was, in fact, as a graduate student in the Vienna Circle, along with some other graduate students like W.V.O. Quine and A.J. Ayer. So they were there doing their PhDs while all this Vienna Circle stuff was going on. And Naess was very much taken by Toman's thinking, because Naess spent a postdoc here at Berkeley in the 1930s. In the 1950s, Toman gives us a paper. Naess said, we need a psychology of science. Okay, a psychology of scientific behavior specifically, and that Toman's got the bottom line on this. No traction, nobody interested, okay? Because no one could quite understand what would be the conception of psychology that would be involved. Because the philosophers were thinking very much in terms of very sort of formal logical structures. And somebody like Toman was saying that logical structures were things that could potentially be found in the environment. And that we could think about logic, as it were, as structuring the environment as a kind of possibility space within which thought and action occurs. And the philosophers didn't know what to make of that. Okay, so there was no traction on the philosophy side, and the psychologists didn't understand what this rap guy was going on about. Okay, especially since he was losing all the major battles within his own discipline. Okay, so Naess actually has a kind of memoir where he goes through the failure of trying to establish psychology of science from the 30s to the 50s. Even though we've got people like Toman, we have Brunswick, we have all these people kind of pushing this line in various ways. And so there's an interesting story about resistance to be told here about that. But I'll end at this point. So in a sense, my point of bringing up Berkeley here is that Berkeley is, you might say, kind of an interesting rhetorical hook for bringing in this entire kind of aspect of the development, where lots of different influences that we might not otherwise think of having anything to do with each other, in fact, converge in very interesting kinds of ways. And I think, I'm sure there's some archive here at this university where one could go through and start putting all these connections together in a more fine-grained detail. Thank you. Yes?
There's an interesting connection. I'm sure he would have gotten to it. Brunswick was a student of Karl Muir and Moritz Schlick. His classmate was Karl Popper.
Yes.
Popper rejected the idea that psychology had anything to offer the understanding of science. Brunswick went exactly the opposite way. Neither one was able really to deal with one the other.
This is. I don't know how well known this point is, but it is worth keeping in mind that Popper was a PhD student of Karl Buehler, just like Brunswick was. And you know, so the PhD was in educational psychology, essentially, right? Popper's. And actually, there's an early work of Popper where he's more friendly to psychology, and I think there is an issue about the rhetoric of psychologism within philosophy. There's this philosopher, Martin Kusch, who's now in Vienna himself, it's basically a history of the debate surrounding psychologism and how this is a swear word that everybody throws at each other at the turn of the last century. Okay, nobody wants to be psychologistic, whatever that is, and what it is could be anything, but you don't want to be it. And I think Popper very much capitulated to that kind of, you know, rhetorical, you know, name calling. Even though Popper, in a way, is kind of the final generation of that sort of issue, I mean, in being so overwrought. And what's involved there is an interesting issue to be explored. But that's a good point. Yeah?
You said that this whole thing of conceptual sieves, which we're now living through with these came from William James, but then William, you also said that William James was somehow in sort of contradictory conversation with European schools.
Yeah.
What was he arguing against, and what happened to that?
Okay, well, he was basically trying to tread a middle ground, you might say, because on the one hand you have kind of what was left of the old associationist empiricist kind of psychology that basically said that concepts sort of got amalgamated through repeated experience. Right, and you know, it's almost like a kind of blending theory of concepts, right? You know, you get enough instances that kind of partially overlap and you get a concept after a while as an emergent property. He was against that because he didn't think, because he was very keen on this idea that he got from the idealists that there is a strong sense of self, and you need a strong sense of self to talk about motivation, purpose, you know, the idea of having a life, right, in any kind of significant way. And that he picked up from idealism. But he didn't like kind of the globalist claims, you know, the kind of ego as such kind of thing, because he thought that sort of thing was kind of a residue of the old theological viewpoint where a lot of the idealists came from, right? Then he said the soul, right? He wanted something a little more experimentally tractable than the soul to be the thing that gathers together, right, our concepts. But he did want to make a clear distinction between us and the world. Yeah?
I guess I'm wondering, what you've learned that would be useful going forward, that is, what's predictive? So one possibility is that, you know, like chemists that make plastic without realizing that it didn't degrade and making gyres, or physicists, you know, that split the atom and weren't really realizing the bomb and so forth. Is there something that we should be worrying about the relativists, that we're not as reflective as we might be, as they reach our... Neuroeconomists are going to suck money out of Walmart visitors.
Yeah.
There'll be no middle class anymore.
Yeah. Okay, no, you're pointing to it, right? Which I really think the point of stressing an autonomous ego, as it were, and somehow using the conceptual scheme to stand for that, is the idea that your thinking about the world has a life to it, has a trajectory. It's not just a snapshot view of things. It's not just, the fMRI moment. Right, because this is the problem that we end up getting into. Right, we have, we tend to be very snapshot, outcome specific. And in fact, what is distinctive about scientific cognition and the way in which you might say it kind of really brings ordinary cognition to a really strong sense is it has longevity. It has there's a project. There's a point. Right, so this idea that you receive contradictions and resistance from the world, but you don't just then end up mirroring the world. Right, you regroup, you recapitulate, you try to reassert what your original ideas were, but in a way that takes account of the new experience. This is the kind of thing that I think James very much got from the German idealist tradition, this kind of dialectical thing, you might say, but he didn't like the metaphysics that went along with it. And the problem with the empiricists was that it wasn't clear how you would justify long-term projects that moved against the grain. Right, in a sense, science is very much a history of moving against the grain of taken for granted views about things. How do you explain that psychologically, other than just the quirks of particular people in particular generations? How do you explain this as a kind of sustained project that's worth pursuing? You see, and I think he was very cognizant of that issue, so that when his examples, when he talks about science, are always these kind of long-termist sort of examples, so like the transition from Aristotle to Copernicus, right? Which is obviously not something that happened in one moment, right? It's obviously not something that you could show happening in a lab, right, or something, but is rather an encapsulation of a process that took several generations. And as you know, Thomas Kuhn made this big point that paradigm shift corresponds to generation shift. Okay, one person to talk about who's relevant from Berkeley on this point is Louis Feuer. Have you heard of him? Louis Feuer? No. I don't want to give you another talk. But if you want to talk about the motivational side of this, why is it that people rebel? Louis Feuer is another one of these guys who's from Harvard, contemporary Stephen Pepper and E.C. Coleman, and actually writes a lot about the conflicts of generations in science. And he is at Berkeley running the interdisciplinary studies program in the late 1950s, right at the period that Thomas Kuhn arrives. He ends up leaving Berkeley because he can't stand the student revolts because he thinks he knows about what generation conflicts are about and he doesn't like them. Interesting point, right? Okay? But the point is that that's another side of the story I haven't gotten. That's the motivational side. He got that from William James. Okay? So that side of the story, which we don't often talk about, you know, is this motivation of pushing ahead, right? So there's not only a cognitive side, but there's a motivational side as well. In a sense, if you look at all the offspring of William James, many of whom ended up getting deposited here, you could start to piece together what that worldview was. But I think it is important that the scientific worldview is not just something you can study in a snapshot. It is something that presupposes that there's a purpose, that it's long-term, that it goes against the grain of taken-for-granted views. I mean, that's the kind of thing we're talking about, right? Sorry.
Treasure trove of information about the history of thought. But you asked. That's what you asked.
Trying to blend in.
Thank you.